thanks for the invitation to come and talk to you guys today. So as the chair announced, so the title of my talk is Electron Doping, the Spin Orbit Mod Phase, and Strontium 3 Reading 207. So this is a bilayer here today. And it's part of our program where we've been working to try and map the mechanism of metal insulator transitions in sort of a growing number of classes of spin orbit driven Mod phases. So first, let me talk about the people who have done the work. So this is my student, Tom Hogan, who's here now. Zhang Chen will be coming here later this year. And they both grown the samples and done all the scattering and transport measurements that I'll be talking to you about. We've collaborated with quite a few people and looking, you know, experimentally, trying to characterize a number of these spin orbit Mach phases. But I'd like to say about Vidya Madhavan, who's been very, very productive collaborating with her, basically doing bulk characterization and scattering in collaboration with her sort of local probe of electronic structure with scanning tunneling spectroscopy. Sort of combining those two techniques has been very insightful. And then also like to acknowledge our collaborators at various neutron sources, Oak Ridge National Lab with Wei Tian, in particular also Zara Mani at Chalk River Lab, where we did a lot of our neutron experiments that we're talking to you about. Okay, so just as an outline, I'll start just by introducing the Runnelson-Popper series of iridates to you guys. Since this is us, there's been a couple of iridate talks already, I think I looked on the program, so but just to refresh in case anybody's come in since then, I'll just sort of introduce and motivate the J effect of 1/2 Mach phase and why we think it's interesting, and sort of highlight some potential ways that you can get unusual metals in that material, in these materials, and then also then I'll talk about our experimental results. In particular, looking at carrier doping into one manifestation of the J effect of 1/2 Mach phase, strontium 3, iridium 207. And then it's all unpublished, so most of it's unpublished, so I'll talk about sort of our working picture of the electronic phase diagram in this system. So the title of the talk, so basically the title of, of this program is Magnetism, Bad Metals, and Superconductivity, and these, the Runnelson-Popper series of iridates definitely fall in the sort of and beyond category, right? So we definitely have magnetism and bad metals, I think, when we dope these materials. Basically, I don't know if you guys know Meatloaf, the artist formerly known as Meatloaf. If he's taught me anything, it's a 2 out of 3 ain't bad. And so I gave that sort of a 2% chance of working here today, but it's a little early for that. let's just talk briefly about the spin orbit Mach phase. If I just kind of pick a helpful system to think about this, we can think of systems that are the sort of potassium 2 nickel fluoride structures, potassium 2 nickel fluorine 4. And we can look at the periodic table, we can go from 3D transition metal cations to 4D to 5D, and with a canonical example, lanthanum 2 cuprate being a mod insulating phase, so D9 electrons, so D4 for the ruthenate. Then you're sort of transitioning as you go from 3D to 4D, you have to start invoking either structural distortions or orbitally selective mod scenario. But then as you go to the 5D transition metal ions, so the iridium 4 plus cation, it actually ends up this system is still an insulator even though you have a dramatically reduced Coulomb interaction. Yes?
What's the definition of U effective, or how do you determine it?
From this, I think this is just people modeling, I guess. For this guy, I think it's just LDA plus spin orbit plus U, and then they tune some effective U. I'm not sure how they...
So this is not an experimental number, this is a theoretical number.
Correct. Okay, So this isn't actually measured, this is just sort of to fit the band structure, for instance. Okay, so a lot of the interest sort of in the discovery of the sort of J effective or spin orbit Mach phase was the seminal example here, strontium 2 iridium 04, where surprisingly, even though you have this 5d5 electron shell, basically you still have an insulating phase, and the idea is that an additional energy scale comes into the problem, which is spin-orbit coupling. And spin-orbit coupling becomes of the same order of the effective U. So if you think of iridium 4 plus cation and oxygen octahedra, it's a cubic crystal field, so in the ideal cubic limit, you have these 5D electrons, you put them in a cubic crystal field, in the strong crystal field limit, you have it splits into a lower T2G and upper EG band. And then you turn on strong spin orbit coupling, and this lower T2G band splits you break the orbital degeneracy and you get a lower J3 halves and upper J1 half. And this ends up being half filled. So, and then if you turn on the effective on-site Hubbard, Coulomb interaction, you split the band into lower and upper Hubbard bands, and you end up with a spin orbit driven Mach phase. So this is relies both on Coulomb interaction and on strong spin orbit coupling in order to get an insulating state. And in the limit of a perfectly cubic crystal field, then you can also write down the wave function as some spin orbit entangled superposition of the Kramer's doublets X, XZ, YZ, and ZX. And it's sort of visualizing the wave function, it's this sort of three-dimensional dimpled cube. Okay, so this is in the perfectly cubic crystal field limit.
What is the little red circle with the white inside me?
That's unoccupied, sorry.
It's completely unoccupied.
Right.
It looks like it's partially up.
I didn't want to draw little spins when we're talking J, so I'm okay. All right, so why is this interesting? So the state's sort of been this essential point for a growing body of literature predicting new states in close proximity to this J effective one half Mach phase. So here's just sort of, it's a cartoon, it's maybe not a literal phase diagram, just sort of giving a snapshot of literature of the different states you can realize as you perturb about the spin orbit Mach phase. With some states which are sort of topologically non-trivial, the wild semi-metal, other states are mapped to sort of unusual magnetic behaviors, for instance, quantum spin liquids. And in addition to that, there's been a number of actual, you know, physical materials, spin orbit Mach materials, where you can potentially perturb about and try and hunt for these states. So one example are the pyrochlore iridates. This is an easy system to tune. You can drive it into the metallic regime via a number of different routes, either by changing the A site or by doping, either changing the A site radius or doping the carriers directly. A different manifestation which we saw, which a number of people talked about in earlier discussion sections, are you take the J effective one half wave function, put it in a lattice, a honeycomb lattice, for instance, or a hypergagomic lattice, where it's edge-sharing octahedra, and then you can map it to a Heisenberg-Pitaev model and potentially realize a quantum spin liquid. But what I want to highlight is basically talking about the Rudolphs and Popper series of irradiates, where symmetries have basically been mapped to the Couperet problem, and there's been predictions that you can potentially realize high-temperature superconductivity, at least in the single-layer system, if you were able to dose sufficient number of carriers. So just to let you know a little bit about the structure, so this is strontium 2 iridium 04, so you guys are mostly familiar with the lanthanum 2 copper 04 structure. This is more or less isostructural. You have two-dimensional iridium oxide planes where each iridium is in the center of an oxygen octahedra. The twist is that these oxygen octahedra in the AB plane can't in a ordered fashion, so they rotate within the plane about 11 degrees, and this correlated rotation effectively doubles the C-axis lattice constant and gives you a root 2 by root 2 reconstruction within the AB plane. And it's known that this system is an ordered antiferromagnet. The ordered moment's about a third of a Bohr magneton. And the moments are actually remain rigidly locked to these oxygen octahedra, and so they can't with the oxygen octahedra in the same correlated fashion. So you have a canted antiferromagnet with a reasonably large net moment if you induce, basically, if you apply a small magnetic field. Okay, so the ordering temperature is 240 Kelvin, and like lanthanum cuprate, this isn't indicative of the actual exchange coupling. It's a very two-dimensional system, so it follows sort of two-dimensional Heisenberg-type behavior. Resonant inelastic X-ray scattering has shown that the nearest neighbor exchange coupling is large, 16 million electron volts. So we have a strongly coupled antiferromagnet with a structure that's similar to the high to lanthanum cuprate, and it's led to a number of different.
Just saying,
yeah.
And J prime is what interpretation? J prime.
I think J prime is just next nearest neighbor.
So it's not simply the nearest neighbor.
Right. Exactly. It's not just nearest neighbor.
That's right.
Okay. So there's been a number of suggestions that you can map this particular problem to the high TC problem and potentially realize a high temperature superconducting phase if you were to dope enough carriers into the system. There's actually been quantitative estimates about how much, what level of electron doping you need to put in order to realize superconductivity. This translates to about 12% electrons. And there's even predictions of the pairing symmetry you should realize. So the limitation here is that it's very hard to dope these systems. So the way you would, to leave the iridium oxide plane intact, you want to dope the A site. And the solubility of the most logical dopant for electrons, putting lanthanum on strontium, is limited to about 5%. So people are working, yes?
Unfair question. Any ideas? I don't know this paper, you know, Watanabe at all. Any ideas what they do to actually produce that phase diagram?
No, they don't.
Okay, fine.
BMC.
Like I said, unfair question.
Some BMC calculation.
What's VMC?
Some zero temperature projector.
For just a J1, J2 Hamiltonian, or what Hamiltonian is exactly the same as it?
No, so it's a Hubbard model, I think.
Just to get an idea of what
kind of thing. I think it's a Hubbard model. It may be more.
So we have J over U still.
Sorry?
In the phase diagram, they still have J over U, so probably they still work as counterforms of some kind.
Well, whatever it is, it's safe because we can't put 12% electrons in it yet. Okay. We can get maybe 5%.
It'd be a three-band model.
What about photodoping it beyond that?
Yeah, that's a good idea. We're playing around with also just our electrostatic gating. Basically, put as much lanthanum as we can in and then try and do some electrostatic gating. If I was good enough at chemistry, then maybe there could be some clever way to interpolate it and try and add more pairs, but we're still working on that, so it's sort of an active thing. All right. But I will say is that there's been a recent study where they basically, for photo emission, where this is by BJ Kim, his group, where they sprayed potassium on the surface, which is nominally doing electron doping, and they see the emergence of sort of Fermi arc states, which is what their report is. So if you think this is relevant to the high TC problem, then maybe there's some symmetry if you're able to dope enough carriers. And so this is just the evolution of the Fermi surface as they develop a full monolayer of potassium on the surface. Okay, so this is sort of tantalizing. So the metal you achieve when you electron dope at least to the surface in this arc photo emission experiment could be an exotic metal.
How much doping is that?
I don't know how they know how much doping is. As a fraction of a monolayer,
you could increase the volume of the Fermi surface.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
And the funny thing is, it doesn't really change much as you add more potassium.
Right.
Is it time shot?
Who was
that?
This is BJ. Okay.
Yeah.
A lot. Kind of D looks like at least it's talking some percentage, right?
Right.
They basically don't know.
I don't know how they would
get any. They keep some estimates in the paper.
Just from the surface
line. Right. Okay. So also the fundamental problem of the 214 system, at least from our perspective, is I want to be able to drive it through metal insulator transition, at least, and study bulk crystals. Can't do that with the 214 system that way, okay? But there is a dimensionality-driven metal insulator transition in the Brunelleschi-Popper series of iridates. Basically, as we add layers, going from the single layer, the 214 system, to the bilayer, the 327 system, it's known from earlier optics results, this is from Noh's group, first author's Moon, that as you increase the dimensionality, basically going from n equals 1 to n equals 2, systems the upper Hubbard band comes down in energy and the effective charge gap gets smaller. And then if you go to the n equals infinity limit, it becomes a metal. So you evolve from a 2D antiferromagnetic insulator to a 3D ferromagnetic metal as you increase the number of layers in the series. Okay. So our starting point was to start with the bilayer system. And the bilayer system, we know, just to be slightly more quantitative, we know that as you go from strontium 214, the effective charge gap is around 600 millielectron volts. In the bilayer system, this is reduced by about a factor of 4, so 130 millielectron volts.
And this is measured.
This is measured. So the gap is measured via STM, and I think it's confirmed by photo emission.
And does the tilting change so the plan renormalizes a bit as well?
The in plane.
The in plane twist.
It's the same, more or less. So yeah, I can show you that here. So this is the bilayer structure. Again, in-plane rotation is still present in the system, so that 10-degree rotation. Within a bilayer, of course, it's, they can be either in phase or out of phase, and they're out of phase. The magnetic structure is slightly different, though, so it is still it's a G-type antiferromagnet, but since the oxygen octahedra is slightly more distorted, the planes basically stretched a bit along the Z-axis. There's a spin reorientation where the moments actually point along the C-axis in this material. The order of moments, it's the same. Within resolution, a third of a Bohr magneton. And if this is a G-type antiferromagnet, again with a high Knell temperature, 280 Kelvin. Excitations have been measured by resonant inelastic X-ray scattering. Again, this is by this is B.J. Kim's work, I believe. And again, you have a large nearest neighbor exchange coupling of 90 milli-electron volts. You also have this very funny, huge spin gap in this material. Okay. So just...
Sorry, the spin gap is because of spin limit coupling.
Is that right?
Yes. I guess fundamentally it has to be,
yes.
Yes.
It's a big effect.
Yeah.
To say that it's...
But funnily, there's not a large spin gap in the 214 system.
Extremely tiny in the 214.
Yeah.
So that's... there are ESR measurements.
Less than
a million. So that's amazing.
Yeah.
ESR is the regular measure. Okay, so just to establish some symmetry for say, experts, in terms of the applicability of the J effective 1/2 model for the strontium 3 iridium 207 system, so it was originally proposed for the 214 system that looking at this asymmetry of the magnetic scattering at the L3 and L2 iridium edges, so so-called branching ratio, you can use this large asymmetry as a metric for determining whether or not you actually have a J effective 1/2 ground state or just a Cramer's bubble of some sort. So you do get the same large branching ratio in the 327 system. And in later calculations, this is by Sala et al., basically shows that this is rigorously correct for the bilayer system where the moments are actually pointed along C. And potentially, this is actually more correct for the 327 system. So this metric is more solid for the 327 system than versus the 214. Basically, in this paper, they showed for the 214 system, if the moments are in plane, if you calculate the resonant elastic cross-section, scattering cross-section, then they expect the branching ratio to be they expect this L2 edge to not be present for any configuration of moments in plane. But for the 327 system, the moments out of plane, this is still a good metric for the J effective 1/2 ground state. Okay, so what we want to do is we want to dope the system to try and look at the metal insulator transition. There's two ways of doing it. We can either alloy the iridium site or the B site, or we can alloy the A site, the strontium site. So our previous results were we looked quite a bit at replacing iridium with ruthenium. We know the endpoint strontium 3 ruthenium 207 is a Fermi liquid near an instability. So we crossed that phase diagram, and it turns out that this metal insulator transition we were able to show is percolative. Basically, you put ruthenium holes in, and they just stay localized until you reach a percolative metal insulator transition. And there's some interesting physics that goes on, I think, in the metallic regime once you've reached once you've gone beyond the percolation threshold, where you have some interface-induced antiferromagnetic states. Bless you.
Thank you.
But this isn't a thermodynamic metal insulator phase transition. So we started working on the lanthanum substitution, and this is data from Dong Sao's group. So it's known that in the 327 system, you can introduce about up to 5%, actually a little beyond 5% lanthanum, and you can truly take it from a metal, this is the parent compound, its resistivity is a function of temperature, into an insulating regime by 5%, okay? What?
You said interchange metal and insulator.
Yeah, sorry. Okay. Yeah, don't listen to me, just look at the data. all right, so they reported something actually kind of unusual, that when it's in the metallic regime, this is 5%, but they still see irreversibility in the magnetization, suggesting it's a magnetically metallic state. But they weren't really sure this could be due to some inhomogeneity in their sample, so they were a little cautious there. So okay, in parallel, we've been looking at this system. So this is our resistivity data as a function of lanthanum substitution. So this is the parent compound in black, You have 1% lanthanum, and you can see the resistivity just collapses quickly. This is orders of magnitude down just in 1% substitution. And then you continue doping at about 5%, and you end up with this metallic phase, which is in agreement with what the Kentucky group cell data shows. We've actually looked at 4%. This is with vidimatin. So if you look at the STM for this system, these are the lanthanum impurities. You can see them. But it's a globally metallic phase, so there's not this coexistence of gapped and gapless regions in the STM spectra, like in the case of the thinning doping. And this is at 4% when it's sort of, you know, the transport looks like this. Okay, so, and also I'll just point out, in this intermediate regime here, where we dope between 1 and 4%, I can just sort of zoom in here, you see this sort of funny shaped transport curve. So there's this broad hump here, and this low temperature upturn. This low temperature upturn fits reasonably well with 3D weak localization. That's our best guess right now for what's driving this upturn at low doping. And this broad hump here, we can take the derivative, and you can see this sort of...
what is 3D weak localization?
What's the form?
Yeah.
It's like 1 over square root of T. Yeah. And what now?
I'll show you.
If you guys have ideas on this transport, I'd love to hear it. Okay, so up here. It's not localization. So then, all right, so then I've done something wrong here.
If you were to translate it into a 2D, is it going to be per square?
It's big, let's see.
It's, it looks big, it's meters.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no meters.
It's 150 microns. KFL is probably 1.
This transport of this intermediate regime, I'll say we don't fully understand. This gave me a good fit. I was just talking to Andy about this the other day, so I thought I would throw this this fit on here.
What's the form you actually fit there?
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is plus some T squared term right at low temperature, right? Yeah.
Well, that's square root. Square root. Square root. Square root. You said it was 1 over square root.
Right.
Right. There's constant minus square root.
Yeah, does it seem to diverge at zero temperature?
It's very weak. Yeah, I mean, we can look at it on the
board. It's not weak, it's a big factor.
Well, that's the current fit I have. Yeah, so if you guys have some suggestions, I'll keep working on it. We can take the derivative. Sort of one of our concerns was just to look at what this feature is here, right? And so this feature maps more or less to this pink here in the parent compound, which we know is associated with the onset of antigravimetric ordering. So we can take the derivative here, and we can look at this minimum, and this maps well to when I look at irreversibility. This is irreversibility and magnetization as a function of temperature. This is the parent compound. This is 280 Kelvin. This is where we know it magnetically orders. So there's some slight net moment in the system. And then we jump 3% in, we can still see there's some magnetic order persists. And this onset temperature matches where I see this sort of hump in resistivity in this intermediate regime. But by 5%, irreversibility is wiped out. We don't see any net magnetization.
Okay. Sorry, so just in that moment, I know in the 214 there's a pretty larger net moment just from canting.
Right. This one is
not really ionizing light, so
there's still some net moment.
There's still some net moment.
Some canting.
Is it smaller? Is it canting?
Or? If you work out canting, it's very small, like half a degree or less. So whatever it is. I mean, I'm the only one who ever really talks about where it comes from. And my theory was just there's some small degree of canting, like half a degree or less. But it's really small numbers, so you can see this extended
amount. It's compound, it's out of plane canting. So there it can be in the plane, and here you have some out of plane canting.
It's Ising ordered, right? And so this is in-plane magnetization. You only see this when you look at the magnetization in-plane. So it would be canted slightly into the plane by half a degree or something. It's very small in the numbers, like 10 to the minus 4 maybe per minute.
trees and.
I don't think it's domain wall contributions. Domains, we can see the domains with neutrons, and those don't really change as a function of temperature. The domain populations, and then this downturn here doesn't correlate to the neutron order parameter. So the magnetic order parameter is seen by neutrons. So it's something subtle that's changing. Yeah. Oh yeah, that's right. But if you do careful X-ray measurements, evidently you can see this.
So the correlation length is not really well measured. It's not really fully right? Limited. So there's some finite size that can be represented. That was my question.
Some small imbalance. Yeah. I guess if it's a subtle effect, then yeah, you can miss everything from this. Because neutrons get like, because we're domain averaging the whole sample, right? We can look at two super lattice reflections and we can look basically how many, their order parameters, if they track which one of them are identical, which they do, but I haven't really calculated what resolution we'd be able to tell, what percentage of that. Yeah, it could be some domain effect, I suppose. Okay, so then we could do neutrons to further characterize the magnetic order. So this is the parent compound, just to keep everybody on the same page. So this is, if you use a tetragonal unit cell, we're looking at the zone center, basically in the plane of a half-half type position. And you have a throbbing unit cell, I'm indexing things as 1-0 type position. So this is an antichromatic super lattice reflection, 1-0-2. So we see, this is the parent compound, which we reported earlier. So you see this nice onset at 280 Kelvin. Then when we start to dope lanthanum to the system, we can see that this is not in absolute units, but it's normalized roughly. You can see basically the onset temperature shifts down only slightly, okay? And the net, basically the ordered moment, the intensity of the magnetic scattering goes down rather dramatically. And this downturn here, we don't quite fully understand yet.
So I'm supposed to take seriously, roughly, it's 30 versus 600?
I'll just show you this. Here's the ordered moment as a function of lanthanum, okay? So the ordered moment comes down, and it's by the time we measure 4%, there's nothing within resolution. So it's very weak. But these are small samples, so if there is some spin density wave phase, we can miss it.
So the nail temperature actually jumps from the 100% from 80 to 40 or something, and then beyond that is a small decrease.
Yeah, I'll show you. I'll plot it all together. If we have more data than that. I just didn't want to overrun. Okay, but I do want to say before I show the sort of the effect, the working phase diagram, is that what we also see is that as we begin to dope a little bit of lanthanum into the system, we see an additional order parameter turn on. Okay, so this is a structural distortion that turns on. It's very subtle, and we basically see an otherwise forbidden Bragg reflection turn on. This is a 1-0 odd type position. So it's the same in-plane sort of pi-pi or half-half 1-0 type wave vector. But this is not magnetic scattering, this is structural.
So that could explain the moment. If it makes the upsites and the downsites inequivalent, they could have different length spins.
Except they already saw the moment in the end of, so.
Yeah, it's basically this reflection isn't there in the camera. Right. And so this structural distortion develops quickly. So this is the lightly doped sample. It's very weak. This is normalized by some primary peak. So this is a nice relative comparison to how strong the super lattice is that develops. So in the lightly lanthanum dope, we see it turn on at very low temperatures. But then as we approach, as we dope more lanthanum to the system, we can see that this order parameter sort of fully develops. It doesn't change much as we go from 3% to 4%. This is very light substitution and this is a very subtle distortion. So one thing we're trying to work is basically, can we try and establish if there's a condenser at CDW that's developing when we start to dope into this material and try and understand exactly what this is and its role in the Mendel-Slater transition. Okay, so if I put all this data together, these are the order parameters. So this is a temperature versus strontium, temperature versus lanthanum concentration. And so this is the parent compound. Again, it's a 280 Kelvin antiferromagnet insulator, and as we dope into the system, you saw that the resistivity drops dramatically, and the antiferromagnetic ordering temperature comes down quickly. well, not quickly, sorry, it sort of suddenly comes down, but the ordered moment crashes completely at this dashed line. Okay? But we also see the development of this additional order parameter, which we know is structural. It's a subtle structural distortion. It's again, it's sort of at the 1-0 in-plane reflection, but in the odd L to Z. And this sort of turns on and becomes fully developed right as anti-ferromagnetism seems to collapse. So I'll call this sort of the T-star, or distorted phase. Okay. Okay, so this is our working phase diagram of the system. Right? We're trying to understand what this distortion's role is in the Magellan-Slater transition. Okay. This hatched region here, I believe, is a first-order coexistence of the two, maybe to do some slight inhomogeneity in the sample. So I don't. So I think this is sort of the first-order line going from here to here. Okay, so one question you can ask is, what kind of metallic state results when you don't lengthen them into this bilayer system? So I will say that as we add lanthanum to the system, the unit cell volume actually swells. Okay, so lanthanum's nominally a smaller cation, but we see the unit cell volume actually increase. So we see funny structural things go on as we add lanthanum into the material. And then once we go beyond where antiferromagnetism dies, it sort of starts to decrease again as we add more lanthanum. We also see, if you look at the parent compound, it has an anisotropic thermal expansion. Basically, the c-axis, as you cool down, gets a little bit bigger, and the a-axis contracts, and that persists in the lightly lanthanum doped system. Again, you see the c-axis gets bigger as you cool down, and the a-axis contracts. But then once we dope 4% lanthanum and nominally kill antiferromagnetism, we see basically that this they both contract as you cool. So basically, this anisotropic thermal expansion term seems to go away. And so one possible idea we're looking at is if there's a tilt mode or something that's locking in as we go across the Magellan-Slater transition. So I will just mention one thing sort of just found out about recently is that you can see similar effects were reported in lanthanum doped strontium titanate, actually, where you have some competition between the size effect of putting lanthanum into the system and also what they calculate sort of correlation energy. This is Chris van der Waals' group, so it's some hybrid density functional. So I'm not quite sure how they got these two terms to add together. But so they were able to model sort of a net swelling as you put lanthanum in the strontium titanate. So whether or not this is relevant, I'm still trying to look into. Okay, so we can ask, okay, fine. The Magellan-Slater transition we put in is analogous to something that you could realize just under pressure. We're putting a smaller cation in. And the literature right now in the system sort of there's some discrepancy whether or not you can actually realize a true Magellan-Slater transition driving with pressure. So this is, I think this is from the Kentucky group. They claim that there's a Magellan-Slater transition somewhere down here under like 40 gigapascal. And this is from Brian Maple's group, where he still claims that at 100 gigapascal you don't see a Magellan-Slater transition. So there's still some ambiguity whether or not you can realize this under pressure. But there is a report that you can also realize a structural distortion under pressure, and they correlate this to the regime where they claim to see a Magellan-Slater transition as a function of pressure. But they just say that basically the slope of the lattice parameters changes beyond some line. The slope is a function of pressure. Okay, so what's known about photo emission?
So the first about the structural transition.
Yeah.
When it's undoped, is it this Bragg reflection, the 109, is an extinction because of maybe reflection symmetry between the two iridium layers and the bilayer? Is it what's the symmetry that prevents that kind of function? Some pointer.
Right.
Somehow that the two iridium layers are becoming an equivalent.
It would be. Right. Yes, it would be that the two iridium layers becoming an equivalent. I'll double check on that and why exactly. I mean, it's effectively pi pi, right? So that's
pi pi.
Intertriangle units. Yes.
Yeah.
But I thought it was the
C axis.
Oh, you're wondering what the C axis.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's the 9, right?
The 9.
Right.
It's odd.
Oh. It's odd, right? Yeah. I'll give that to you. I'll walk down with it. Okay. So what's known about sort of the metallic state? So these are two recent reports, maybe a few weeks ago of on this lanthanum goat strontium 327 system, so we're sort of slightly different. So one report claims to see a negative compressibility, namely as they dope electrons in the system, they see the chemical potential go down. I'm not a code emission expert, so I can't really justify how they come about this. I think they were looking at, somehow they're looking at some absolute measurement of the chemical potential. And they claim as they dope electrons that the things shift downward. So that I don't understand. So the second one, this is from Felix Baumberger's group. Basically, they measure the Fermi surface. This is in 6.5% lanthanum doped. And they're basically, the gist is they're claiming it's a weakly correlated metal. They extract some two-dimensional Sommerfeld coefficient, which they claim matches their unpublished heat capacity results. Yeah?
So stupid question. How should we use this graph? What is the Fermi surface? Is it centered around gamma point?
Yes, centered at gamma, and then you have these pockets here. So this is
centered at pockets are different things. So let's try to see what's there. So maybe you can show us just where the Fermi surfaces are on this graph.
I think there are these funny.
These are pockets.
Yeah, these pockets, right?
And is there anything? I see something that looks like centered. Circle around gamma point.
Right. That's the data that they've shown.
Okay.
So I think.
They claim that it's weakly correlated and based on what?
Okay, so as far as I can tell, they're claiming it's weakly correlated because they can calculate in photo emission a Sommerfeld coefficient somehow. Okay, I don't know how. And they claim it's 9 millijoule per mole per Kelvin squared, which they claim it matches thermodynamic measurements that they've done, which are not part of the paper, okay? So, they measure the density states and they calculate some effective and some two-dimensional level.
Well, do you know what they expect to do at Fermi surfaces?
No, I don't actually. I've asked Chris van der Waal to calculate or something for me, but
I can imagine going to calculate it. Okay.
I'm sure it's probably around somewhere. So one issue is this is under 6.5% lanthanum doping. So we looked, this is our heat capacity data on our 4.5% lanthanum doping, and we get a slightly larger gamma point. Okay? So, and this we just measured like 2 days ago. So I don't know how to reconcile this with their report. But to me it sort of suggests that there's some remnant correlations. I mean, it's not a huge gamma term, but it's bigger than one. Okay, so just to summarize, we've been working on looking at the phase diagram of lanthanum dopes strontium 327, and we're trying to understand what exactly drives the transition from the insulating to the metallic regime here as a function of electron doping, lanthanum substitution. And there seems to be an additional structural order parameter that comes in and sort of either competes or destabilizes the antifermanic order. And so this T star transition to, I mean, right now, under my understanding, has two possibilities, right? It could be a nearby sort of charge density weight instability. It's commensurate, so that's harder to prove. Or it could be a nearby structural instability, like if the system is just sort of fairly stable. I would say our experimental picture right now suggests a charge density weight. We can do calcium substitution in the system. It's a smaller, it's roughly the same size as the lanthanum. And it does nothing. So it just remains insulating up to 5%. And something interesting seems to be going on with this lattice well, remember, light electron substitution. So, I know it was a little data heavy, but it's our working picture. So, you guys are the right audience to try and figure things out. So, thanks very much for your attention. Yeah.
You already said this, but can I say again? What's the evidence that MIT coincides with the destruction of Einstein?
Oh, no, sorry, yeah, that shouldn't be at MIT. I mean, I think nominally, it depends on how you want to define the metallic phase, I guess.
Is there any artifice that shows what happens with the pockets when you...
No. Yeah, so the samples we've sent under very light lanthanum substitution, they have a hard time getting good data, so there's not much there for them to see. I guess they're charging.
What was the
doping concentration of the one that you showed that had the light pockets?
So they claim that, I don't know if this was measured or if it was actually just nominal doping concentration, but it's 6.5%.
So if it's the CDW that's there in that picture, we should be seeing.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I mean, I can tell you sort of what, I mean, so Alessandra Lanzara has been looking at our samples that are doped with lanthanum, and she sees a small gap in the metallic regime. We don't know the origin of that yet. That could be affiliated maybe with CDW, I'm not sure.
But again, on the CDW idea, the structure without the orthorhombicity or whatever happens is like body sensitive tetrahedron, is that? So you've got a pair in the middle as well as a pair there. So to get this odd cue up the C-axis, it just means the pair in the middle is not cancelling the interference with the pair at the bottom. So why do you think there should be in-plane modulation? I'm thinking that the order must be something to do with the C-axis. Yeah.
Well, but it also is at pi pi.
Was it at pi pi or was it?
Pi pi in the tetragonal unit cell.
Right.
Okay. In the tetra. Right. Okay. But that was already broken.
By the end.
By the tilting.
By the structure.
So I just am trying to understand whether something different happens in plane as well as out of plane.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer, but I will say that we've struggled with the fine details of the structure.
Right.
Currently, the picture is of BBCB as the space group. Which is, I think the same space group as the ruthenate, bilayer ruthenate. Okay, so we're still trying to verify that that's correct. There's some potential subtle variations from that.
How did the net moment, how did that vary with doping?
Yeah, so the net moment,
not the staggered moment.
It seems kind of sporadic, let's see. Right. It's really tiny, it goes up and then it just collapses. I think we don't have data in between here yet, unfortunately. So for like 4%, for instance, that'd be nice to know.
At zero doping, it seems to go down again at low temperature to something small.
Right, so this guy, if you look at this, this is kind of a finer detail, I suppose, but this downturn here, the original report by the Kentucky group actually said they're going negative. We've never seen it go negative, but we always see it in the parent compound. There are other groups that claim they don't see it, but I would say three of the four groups that have been making this material see it.
So coming back to, it's robust in this sort of coexistence region. And here, I mean, could be that you have some charge density wave order near domain walls of the antiferromagnetism or something.
A little bit of ferromagnetic moment,
and
there may be a domain wall.
But that would give you a ferromagnetic moment. Yeah.
I mean, this correlates to a feature in transport as well, the magneto resistance you see a minimum at that downturn temperature. It's not really understood what exactly is going on, but it could be like the main wall changing population.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in the parent compound, you said there's a large spin gap.
Right.
And in the doped cases, what happens to the spectrum?
I don't think that's been done yet, or hasn't been published yet. No one's told me what happens. I don't know. Do you know Yang Zhong? For the 327.
No, I don't know.
I haven't seen anybody publish that yet. We put in a proposal to try and measure, but I don't know if it was done or not. We'll try.
And what's the question from?
Yeah.
Where is that heat localization? And what temperature range?
It's pretty. Right.
Is this supposed to be 2D or 3D?
I fit it to what I thought was a 3D form, but I guess there was some pushback that there isn't a 3D form.
Yeah, so. So you think it's at 50 degrees and below?
Right.
Well, surely KFL is one or less than that, isn't it?
Less, well less.
I'm sorry?
For these numbers, it's well less.
Well,
this is something like 10 milliohm centimeters. At,
no, Steve, that's 10 to minus 6, right?
Yeah.
Meters.
Meters.
Oh, meters.
Oh, meters. Okay.
So,
for example, you have this weak 109 K coin coming up with the module K, and is there a possibility that there's a second K is associated with 109? So, small fraction with slightly different properties.
Yeah, so we've done that. We've ground up the crystal and we've done the X-rays. We never see another phase come in. But then you can argue that it's some intergrowth that's whatever, some small percentage that X-rays would miss, I guess. Let me think what I can say to that. So with STM and chemical characterization, be it every which way we can do it, you know, WDS, all this stuff, lanthanum seems to be going in with the numbers that I'm saying here. Okay. With STM, this is sort of a homogeneous metallic phase, and they haven't really seen any huge inclusions that we've seen. So if this is some secondary phase, it would be rather surprising to me that it would be so systematic. And not show up anywhere. Right. But I will say that in this region, we don't have any evidence that sort of this transition talks to the anti-dark magnetic transition. So I think that is definitely some misinterpretation problem. But it's a good question. We haven't seen any evidence of it. We've tried looking hard, but you can always argue, I guess, there's some small feature.
For the surfaces, do you cleave in a mirror plane? Is there a mirror plane that it...
It cleaves... I think it cleaves here at this rock salt thing. So
there's no charge necessarily at the surface.
Yeah, I don't think there's necessarily any charge.
I think you asked me to remind you when it's 10 hours, so unless you're teaching down the hallway.
No, it's fine.
The students will probably wait.
They have to give presentations today, so they'll be glad to wait, probably.
Yeah, so on one of those curves, you had a 10% doped sample.
Yeah.
It was much more conductive, and you never said anything about it.
Yeah, it's a small sample. We couldn't do anything with that. They get really small when we put that much in. But photo emission is measured some up towards that doping. Where is that? Ray Watts data. Yeah, so I think... this they measured up to about 8 or 9%, but those samples are just really tiny, and so I think the student was lucky to get leads on.
Is this
no. Yeah. I just summarized their data here. It's online. It was posted several weeks ago, so. But I don't know the details about how they can determine how the chemical potential shifts on an absolute scale.
You know, here in these features in the Fermi surface, if they claim something about the orbital character, because J1/2 have all these different orbital mix, did they say something about this feature comes from like XY orbitals, which are more or less in plane, or that was not said?
I don't remember off the top of my head. I don't want to tell you something wrong.
So once upon a time, Vidya showed me some SDM data with defects, which probably were not lanthanum, because those were fairly benign. But the ones that she saw on one of the samples seemed to have some sort of chiral character.
Oh, that's okay. So there's a long story to that, right? So she, you know, STM, they have a hard time tunneling into insulators in general.
Yeah.
And so she basically took these parent compounds and she just, her postdoc just kept trying them. And eventually she got one that either via the cleave or via the intrinsic property of the sample was, there's some slight oxygen defects. And
okay.
So these oxygen defects created these little chiral impurities that she was studying. And then that actually allowed her to tunnel in, so.
Does it know where they sit?
I think these were the apical oxygen sites is where she determined theirs.
And there's vacancies or there's something else sitting there or what?
There was a vacancy, an apical oxygen vacancy, and then that was what was inducing that chiral density of states.
That story has nothing to do with this. You don't see those in the sample you're studying.
She never sees them in the lanthanum doped or ruthenium doped systems. In fact, yeah, I mean, she had to look kind of hard to find those in the parent compound either.
Okay, I don't see any further questions, so let's thank the speaker.